Darling one, you were born from the sweetest love, cast from the fires of creation, burning bright into the making of your perfect constellations. Head high, my love, never let them diminish you. Stand tall in the power of your love. Break open to the thousands come before you, written in your heart with holy blood. Keep going, my love. Hold tight to the scripture of your inheritance, your dreams born from ancient stone. Weave your magic, star of wisdom, breathing life into hollow bones. Courage, my love. Place pain upon your sacred altars. Grow seeds where life has become hopeless. Lend hands to those who fall and falter. Let love be life's greatest opus. Hello and welcome, welcome, welcome to Dreaming the Ancestors. My name is Tara Wild, and this podcast is all about remembering and reclaiming ancestral stories, feminine wisdom, and earth magic. And today I'm really excited to welcome Mara Starling to this podcast. This is the 10th episode of the second season. Mara Starling was born in North Wales, raised on the Isle of Anglesey, and is a native Welsh speaker. She's been practicing witchcraft from a very young age and has been featured in various television series and documentaries, both in Welsh and English. She also has a book called Welsh Witchcraft, A Guide to the Spirits, Lore, and Magic of Wales. And I'm so honored to welcome Mara. So I'm going to bring her on just for a moment here.
Oh, hello. Thank you so much for inviting me to be here. It's absolutely glorious to see you.
I really am so excited for our conversation. I know so little about the Welsh traditions, and I know that lots of my followers and people who listen to this podcast have Welsh ancestry, and I often get questioned, you know, do you teach the Welsh traditions? Where can I find people who teach it? So this is really wonderful to have you on, and I hope that everyone enjoys listening to Mara's wisdom. As always, to begin this podcast, I would really love to start by welcoming in our ancestors. And I invite us all to take a moment to close our eyes and imagine that we're having this conversation in the flesh, heart to heart, and we're sitting on the ground around a great fire. And we're sharing wisdom, we're sharing stories, just like our ancestors have done since time immemorial. Going way, way back into the mists of time. And I invite you to take a few deep breaths as you really feel this experience of being gathered around the fire and connecting to the heart through the fire. And as we hold this visualization, this experience in our hearts, our minds, our bodies, I'm going to begin our ancestral honoring. So I'd like to welcome in my ancestors of blood and bone. I'd like to welcome in my ancestors from the Celtic Isles, from England, Ireland, and Scotland. Fulcha, Nishan, Shinsher, welcome to the old ancestors. Welcome to the grandmothers, the grandfathers. And I'd also like to honor the ancestors of the lands that I'm on, which are the ancestral lands of the Ute and Arapaho people in the mountains of so-called Colorado. And I'd also like to welcome in the ancestors of all of our lineages and to feel that all of our ancestors are coming to this place of connection, seeing one another, and to know that when we go back far enough, we are all related. I once heard that if you go back just 1,000 years in Europe, every single person that's alive today is related through that ancestral connection from up to 1,000 years ago. And that feels really, really potent for us to remember. So thank you, beloved ancestors, honoring my ancestors and the ancestors of this land and all of our ancestors. And with that, I will pass over to you, Mara.
Thank you. I'd like to take a quick moment now that we are here, and our purpose and our intention for this evening is to discuss the magic, the lore, and the very legacy that has been left by the cultural continuum of Wales. I'd like to take a moment to just honour the land itself within its native name, Cymru. We may know it as Wales today, a name that was given to this land by those who came from over the seas, but those who were native here referred to it as Cymru. Cymru, which can translate to mean comrades or those who we are close to. And just take in the moment to really acknowledge what that meant. Those who were near and dear to us, the countrymen, those who were around us. Cymru. O Gymru fynyddig paradwys y bardd, pob dyffryn, pob clogwyn, i'm golwg sydd hardd. Drwy deimlad gwladgarol, mor swynol yw si, ei nentydd afonydd i mi. O mountainous region, whose fair to my eyes, whose precipice and mountains inspire me so deeply. O land of the mountains, the bard's paradise, quicken our fire, quicken our blood, inspire us with the awen that ranges through this land. And I also call to the spirits of my ancestor, Cyfarchion, I ysbrydion y tir, ac ysbrydion hynafol y tirlyn o'n gwmpas, to the ancestral spirits that reside within this land. We honour thee and we call to thee. Byddwch yma nawr, be here now. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mara. Really feeling the power of your invocation, and really beautiful to hear the native language. And thank you for bringing in the native name of Wales. And I'm going to attempt to say it, and you can correct me, Mara, because it's a little hard to say. Cymraeg?
Yes, so Cymraeg is the name of the language and the people, mm-hmm. and Cymru is the name of the land. Cymru.
Thank you, Cymru. I invite everyone who's listening to practice that as well, because it feels really, really beautiful and important to honour the native name of these lands that we'll be speaking of. Yeah, thank you so much, Mara. So the title of this episode is Welsh Witchcraft and Women of Welsh Mythology, and I'm really excited for this conversation, and I know that there's so much beautiful wisdom and mythology for people to connect with from these beautiful lands. So for anyone with Welsh heritage in particular, this is going to be a really valuable episode for you. Wales is a country that's full of legends and myths about the spiritual world, stories of sacred lakes and healing herbs, women of magic, and the mighty red dragon. The land remembers these stories and these ancient ways of mystery and magic, traditions that have their roots in old Brythonic Britain. And there are some really fierce and magical women in Wales's ancient mythology who embody the archetype of the witch in a variety of ways, which we'll be exploring in this episode. So Mara is going to share some wisdom about these mythic women, what it means to be a modern day witch, and the Welsh magical traditions. So Mara, I would love to begin by just hearing a little bit about your personal journey. How did Welsh witchcraft become important to you? And how has this wisdom path really unfolded for you over the years?
Of course. So hello to everyone listening who might not know me. My name is Mara Starling. I'm from an island that's at the very tippy top of Wales, right in the very north of Wales, called Ynys Môn in our native language. Ynys Môn, which got translated into English as Anglesey for reasons unbeknownst to me, to be honest. We get the name Ynys Môn. Ynys means island in Welsh. And Môn comes from the Roman word mon, which was described as the name of this place within Roman historical texts. And it was said that historically this place was always quite sacred. It was a teaching ground for druids. It was said that the druids across all of Europe would pilgrimage to Anglesey, to Ynys Môn, to Mona, in order to train, to undertake their training as druids, before then going out into the world and sharing their druidic wisdom and being leaders within their community. communities. So I was always kind of immersed in the magic of this landscape from a very, very young age. I absolutely adored the stories of druids and giants and witches and fairies from the landscape. And I remember when I first went to school, when I first started primary school, that was the first thing I told my teachers was, oh, I love fairies and magic and witchcraft. And luckily, because I went to such a rural school in the middle of nowhere, the teachers kind of had free rein. They could do whatever they wanted. And they started teaching me about all these myths and legends, pointing me in the direction of all these glorious books about the subject, but also sharing them orally as well, because we are at heart an oral tradition. We're not really a culture that likes to write things down. We're more of a culture that likes to share stories and share songs. And it's really interesting, that word song, because in Welsh, the word can, or the word canu, which translates nowadays into English as song or singing, the word in Welsh has a much more broad meaning. Can mean song, but it can also mean story, it can mean prose, it can mean poetry, it can mean anything that we share and recite with sacred kind of inspired breath to one another, so long as we are touched by the awen, which is the Welsh force of divine inspiration. Then we are singing, essentially, regardless of whether we're actually literally singing. We are singing anyway, we're singing from our very soul. And you know, that part of my culture was what always sang to me on a deep and visceral level. And I also had a rather magical grandmother, Nain. We say grandmother as in North Wales, we say Nain. And my Nain, I refer to her as Nain Mumu, like Mumu like a cow, because she lived on a farm with lots of cows. So we called her Nain Mumu. And she was considered quite a magical woman. She was a tea leaf reader, a diviner. She loved anything that was inherently magical. And she shared that with me. And I always thought she was my best friend. You know, she was my best friend in the whole world. She was the only person in my entire family that really stood up for me and saw me for who I was. She didn't see me based on what I looked like or the roles and labels that were assigned to me. She saw me as me, and she empowered me and encouraged me to just be my most authentic self. But unfortunately, she died when I was quite young. She died when I was just in my preteens. And at the exact same moment when she died, I discovered witchcraft. I discovered witchcraft and paganism and magic. And I remember it was kind of like an anchor for me, because it helped me to cling on to that little bit of magic that she shared with me, that little bit of enchantment that she brought into my life. I remember vividly, I went to a little town called Llangefni on Anglesey, and I went into this little shop and I found a book, and it was this little dinky yellow book, and it was called Spells for Teenage Witches. And I fell in love because I looked at it and I thought, this makes me think of Nain. This makes me think of her and all the things she used to teach me. And I got so obsessed with this book. I started doing all the spells in it. I started living my life via the teachings that this book, even though it was very, very basic, very vague, but it was still like a lifeline for me at that point in my life as a strange little thing from North Wales that didn't have much friends and had just lost my grandmother. It was like, this was my lifeline. And I remember speaking to my mother. We weren't a very religious family, so it was very okay to talk about things like witchcraft and magic. It wasn't considered taboo at all, especially in Wales. I mean, we're surrounded by the stuff, so of course we're going to talk about witchcraft and magic. But I talked my mother's ear off about this book so much that she started getting annoyed with me. And so she said to me, do you remember when you were in school, when you were younger, and there was a teacher called Mrs. Franklin who used to come and teach you art? And I said, yes, I remember Mrs. Franklin, because she made us create this gloriously huge mural depicting a scene from Welsh mythology. I loved her. She was amazing. My mum went, well, she's a witch, so you should go speak to her. You should go find out everything you need to find out about witchcraft from her, rather than annoying me with all this knowledge that I don't have an interest in. So off I went, I toddled off, and I met Mrs. Franklin. And I remember going to her door and asking her, please teach me everything that you know about witchcraft. And she was quite an intimidating lady. She was very warm and kind, but she was also quite intimidating and scary. I remember her looking down at me and just like kind of feeling like she was undressing my entire soul with her eyes, like looking into an aspect of myself that I couldn't see. And she just looked at me and she went, okay, I'll teach you. but it won't be easy. And I remember just feeling so magical at that moment. And that's what we did. We started learning from each other. We started going to these glorious burial mounds and ancient monuments that dotted around the island. And we started practicing magic together. And sometimes it was deeply like spiritual and calm and serene, where we would sit and we would just listen to the wind or listen to the movement of the trees. And she would tell me to, you know, listen deeply and hear the sounds that are usually unheard by ordinary people walking through the woods. And those moments, you know, are very kind of, ooh, amazing and magical. Other moments were a bit more wow, chaos and all over the place. I remember being on top of a burial mound one night, and we were dancing with firelight and under the stars. It was a glorious summer night, and she was there in her white robes with her huge breasts swinging like pendulums as she danced around. She was just glorious and magnificent. And through her, I met the Anglesey Druid Order, who were a kind of group of modern druids on the island, reviving the ancient traditions of druidry that we had in this land. And through them, and specifically Christopher Hughes, the kind of leader of the order, I learned about a stream of paganism that was embedded within Welsh mythology and Welsh culture. So I took the teachings that Julie gave me, which were based in witchcraft and folk magic, and I took the teachings that Christopher and the Druid Order gave me, which were rooted in druidry and Welsh mythology, and I created my own little version of witchcraft, which was inspired and informed by the traditions and the practices of the past, while being very rooted in the here and now and in who I was as a modern Welsh person. And that was it. I became a Welsh witch, or as I say in my native language, I call myself a Swin Wraig, which doesn't have a direct translation. We can translate it literally to mean charm lady or charm woman. Swin Wraig or Swin Ord or Swin Idd were terms that were given to magical practitioners. And I kind of adopted that term for myself. So when I speak in Welsh, I'm a Swin Wraig. But when I speak in English, the closest term is witch. So I use Welsh witch or Welsh folk witch just as a kind of the closest thing I can say. So hopefully some of that makes sense.
Thank you so much, Mara. Oh my gosh, you told that story so beautifully. And I feel that you have this gift for storytelling, which is really beautiful. And I just always love hearing about how people get started on this path, because it's always so unique. And it's really interesting how sometimes it is that magical grandmother gives you that little inspiration that kind of opens something up. So it was really beautiful mm-hmm. hearing about her. And yeah, just really honoring your path. It's really, really beautiful. And I can feel the magic of your devotions. I find it really interesting that, you know, you're talking about how magical Wales is and how it's really just part of the culture. And I find it really interesting that Wales almost completely avoided the witch trials that ravaged England and Scotland and a lot of Europe through, you know, the 1500s to the mid 1700s and sometimes even beyond. Apparently only 5 people, I think it was, who were convicted of witchcraft in Wales during that time. And I'm really curious about your thoughts on this. You know, why do you think that Wales, you know, rejected these convictions? And what might this tell us about attitudes in Wales at the time towards women and magic?
Absolutely. It's so interesting. I remember when I first learned about this, because I remember thinking when I was a child, you know, we learned about things like the Pendle Witch Trials, which happened over in Lancashire in England. And we learned about the Salem Witch Trials, which happened all the way across the Atlantic. And I always remember thinking, did we not have any? Why do we never talk about it in school and such? Why do we never learn about it? And then as I grew older, I learned the reason for that is because it's so bloody complicated. It's so all over the place. And there's just so much that we don't understand about it yet. So yes, compared to England and most of Europe, really most of Western Europe, we didn't really have as many witch trials. We didn't go through this hysteria, as some people call it. And it's really strange that that is the case, because we share, you know, a border with England. We're right here. And just across there, just in England, we had so many going on. There's upwards of 2,000 trials alone in England, and hundreds upon hundreds of people executed on accusations of witchcraft over there. And then you come into Wales and it's like, where are they? Why are they virtually non-existent here? Why do we only have this small group, this small handful of people? And then when you dig deeper and you learn that even that small handful, even those little tiny pockets of Wales that had witch hunts, most of those were areas that were along the border or were highly anglicised. So they were areas that were being influenced by England. And a lot of them took place later on in that period of about 200 years during the early modern period when this was all happening. It all happened quite later and in areas that were liminal, that were kind of these places along the borderlands. And I find that just fascinating, and I have looked into a few of the theories surrounding it. There is one theory that is very fantastical that I love, and it has to do with fairies or the belief in fair folk within this land. So we have within Wales what is quite a strong fairy faith, a faith within the fair folk that persisted and still persists in some little rural areas to this day, but definitely persisted throughout the early modern period. Where people believed that, you know, these fairies, these liminal beings, and when I say fairy, I don't mean the small Tinkerbell types that we see in Disney films. I mean these liminal otherworldly entities that are very much rooted in this idea of otherness and in the idea of the natural world. So they're these beings that could be very rooted to the natural landscape, or they're considered completely otherworldly, these other entities that come through. And the theory surrounding fairies and how that might have influenced witches and witchcraft in Wales is that if you lived in Surrey or somewhere in England, in Essex or whatever, and you suddenly had a deep bout of bad luck hit your way, all of your cattle just dropped dead in an instant, you're more likely to go, ooh, that was because of Wendy down the road. She cursed me. She's a witch. I'm going to go and take her to trial because she killed all my cattle. Whereas if you lived in Pontypridd or in Glamorgan or in Aberfraw on Anglesey, and it happened to you because you were Welsh, all your cattle suddenly drop dead, you are more likely to go, oh my gosh, it's those damn fairies again. It's the damn fairies. They've done something. I've offended them. I need to ward them away. I need to make sure that I consult my local magical practitioner so that this doesn't happen again. So, you know, when bad luck came to people in Wales, they were more likely to go to magical people than they were to blame them for it. They were more likely to go ask for help. Because the magical specialists were learned in things like fairies, they understood these fair folk that were sometimes dangerous and mysterious. They weren't always these, you know, nowadays in a lot of New Age spirituality, fairies are often black and white. They're either these glorious nature spirits, beings of light who are amazing and heal you and do all sorts of wondrous blessings, or they're these horrendous, hideous creatures that cause all sorts of mischief and strife. When in reality, it's more the middle. They can be good. They can be bad. They're more like us as humans. They're just as diverse as we are. So you'd go to your local cunning woman or cunning man or Swinwraig, your charm lady, and you'd go, this has happened to me and I don't understand fairies. Can you do something about it? And they'd go, yes, of course. So that's one theory that I love, but a lot of academics kind of poo-poo that theory and say, we don't like that because it involves fairies. And if we agree that that theory is correct, then we have to admit that fairies are a thing worth studying. So they kind of poo-poo that theory. So the theory they propose instead is that thievery was more of an issue in Wales at that point, because when we look at the court records, one thing that's quite remarkable about Wales during this period is that we had really extensive written records of trials. And that's how we know that this was definitely a thing, that the witch trials were not as huge here as they were across the border. A lot of people sometimes go, maybe you just forgot that they happened. And it's like, no, because we have such extensive court records from this time period that we would have them in written record if they did happen. And the thing that's interesting is in the same 200-year period that the witch trials were really big over the border, we had a hysteria of our own relating to thieves rather than witches. We were more concerned about people stealing our cheese and our sheep than we were about witchcraft at that period. So that's kind of a theory a lot of academics like to cling on to, is this idea that we were just too concerned with thieves. We didn't care about witchcraft. But to give a kind of third theory, the one that I'm more likely to agree with, the theory that a lot of people who actually look into it from a more holistic level, and by that I mean looking at it from all angles rather than just trying to look at it as a historical or legal or logistic kind of level, the people who try and look at it as an all-encompassing thing, looking at folklore, looking at folk custom, looking at belief and superstition at the time, they're more likely to say that the actual reason we didn't have that many witch trials is because the very concept of the witch as this hideous, monstrous creature that caused panic and fear and terror in your community, it just didn't exist here. Now, witchcraft today has been reclaimed to become this glorious and magical thing that's very empowering. But historically, witchcraft was always considered this really monstrous and transgressive thing. It was a scary and deadly thing. It was all curses and malicious intent and very much rooted in malefic forms of magic. And we just didn't have that in Wales. We didn't understand that because magical practitioners have been so rooted within our culture for so long that someone telling us that it's all bad is kind of ridiculous to our eyes. And the biggest example of why this is true in my eyes is the terminology used around the witch trials. So we have the word gwrach in Welsh, which describes a witch, but that term was never used during the witch trials because it's kind of a more modern term for a witch. And by modern, I mean like 17th, 18th century. I have very weird semblance of time, but in kind of the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries, the term gwrach became this term that became associated with older women who were a bit weird. So it was almost like a slur directed at older women who didn't fit into the conformist nature of society at the time. So gwrach is more akin to like hag or something like that within that context rather than witch. And it only became witch within like a Halloween sense later on in time. Whereas when we look at folklore, a gwrach is actually more of this monstrous ogre-like being that lives in the landscape and doesn't really fit with our definition of witch today. And also, gwrach before that was just a word that was used to describe anything that was disgusting and icky. So we go gwrach about anything. And you can hear it in the word, can't you? It sounds icky. It's like gwrach. But we had all these other words historically that are kind of used more kind of further into the mists of time than gwrach is to describe magical practitioners, like gwyddan. And gwyddan is a word that means witch or magical practitioner, but it also means those who know the trees, those who know the natural world. Then we have, as the term that I describe myself as, swinwraig, which essentially just means somebody who is learned in the art of enchantment. They're learned in the art of enchantment. And then we have like dyn hysbys or dyn cyfarwydd, which is cunning man or familiar man, and also gwraig cyfarwydd, which is a familiar woman. And all that term means essentially is that they're familiar with the hidden aspects of life. So we have such a deeply rooted culture of magic. And yet the word gwrach, nor swinwraig, nor gwyddan, none of these native terms that we have for witches and magical practitioners were ever used during the witch trials that did take place here. The word that was used instead was wits. And that, to me, wits, it's just a borrowing of the word witch turned Welsh. Witch, wits, it's just the same word, Welshified. So the fact that we didn't understand what the witch was to such an extent that we were like, what are we convicting again? Witches? Witches? Okay, if you say so. And the other fact that makes this so believable to me is that reverse witch trials also happened more commonly than witch trials. So though we only had about 5 people that were executed or convicted on accusations of witchcraft, we had just over 40 trials in total. And of those 40 trials, a lot of the people, especially the women who were convicted of witchcraft, then took their accusers to court in a reverse witch trial. And the reverse witch trial is essentially the accused witch, after being found not guilty of witchcraft, takes the person who accused them of witchcraft to court for slandering their name. And though witchcraft trials usually led to a not guilty convict in Wales, the actual reverse witch trials, where women would take their accusers to court under slander, they were often found guilty of slander. So it's more likely that the court would favour these women who had been basically slated by their community as witches than they were to take the favour of their accusers. So to me, it's just obvious that obviously the actual concept of this malefic witch just didn't exist within our culture. We didn't understand it. And how could we, when we have figures like Ceridwen, the witch goddess, this goddess who is the muse to the bards, who is very much connected to the concept of divinity within Wales, how could we consider the witch evil and demonic when we have figures like this who are pivotal to our very culture?
Thank you, Mara. Wow. I was just drinking in every word. So fascinating and so potent to really feel all these different ways that the magic of the land was just woven through the culture. And so this idea of a malevolent witch was just completely foreign. And I've kind of looked into this topic in Ireland, and it was a very similar thing. The witch trials in Ireland came more from areas that were very Presbyterian, and there was a lot of Scottish immigration and influence in those areas. So a very similar story. And I love that you brought in Ceridwen, and would love to talk about some of the powerful women of magic in Welsh mythology. So maybe you could talk to us a little bit about some of these goddesses who have that archetype of the witch, and tell us a little bit about them. You can kind of introduce them and maybe some of the ways that they use witchcraft in their mythology.
Absolutely. The interesting thing about Welsh mythology in general is that there's a lot of debate about where it comes from. And I think it's good to give like just a little bit of a background of that first, because when we think about the gods and goddesses of Wales within kind of a pagan context today, what a lot of people don't know is that the gods and goddesses that we think of when we think of Wales today, we don't glean information about them from ancient, you know, knowledge that has been passed down from some pre-Christian past. We didn't find shrines to Ceridwen or Rhiannon along rivers or lakes that were pre-Christian in nature. A lot of this information comes from medieval manuscripts, which were written down in a very Christianized period. So a lot of academics like to kind of disregard them as gods because of that, because the first written record we have of them comes from a Christianized period. So the idea of them being goddesses or gods is kind of unheard of to these academics. They're like, I don't like that idea, because they were around during a Christianized period of Wales. So they didn't believe in gods and goddesses other than the Christian God at this point. But I kind of challenge that, because I think that there's an aspect of these gods and goddesses that are quite obviously older than the written record. So though we know that these characters come from these medieval manuscripts, we also know that they're likely, and this is agreed upon by most scholars today, they're likely from an older oral tradition of storytelling. The big debate is how old. How old is that tradition of storytelling? Does it predate Christianity? I think kind of yes. I think that there are echoes and hints towards an older Celtic mythology within these stories. And the fact that we have concepts such as the other world and magic and witchcraft embedded in the stories is kind of telling of that to me. But then you have other people who argue that they're not. So the argument I always give is, well, regardless of whether they're gods and goddesses in the past, they are now, because we revere them. And there's this thing called the process of apotheosis, which is the process of making something divine. So regardless of whether they were gods and goddesses in the past, they are today. And I dare any academic who thinks that Ceridwen is not a goddess to go to Bala, where Hin Tegid, where her story takes place, is, and walk into the goddess temple that is there along the banks of the lake and tell the people who run that temple that their goddess is not a goddess, and see what reaction they'd get. So I just wanted to kind of give that information quickly, because it's important to acknowledge that these stories were written down during the medieval period when Christianity was the main religion here. Because when we look at the women of the Mabinogi, when we look at the women of Welsh mythology, they're quite weird. They're quite unique. So when we look at medieval mythology and, well, medieval literature, I should say, rather than mythology, when we look at medieval literature across Europe during the same period, most women, most female characters within a lot of this literature, they tend to fit into two categories. They're usually pigeonholed into two types of women. And the way that a lot of scholars have kind of categorized this is that every woman within medieval literature, medieval Christian literature, tends to fit into either Eve or Mary. So they're either Mary, as in this beautiful, pious, brilliant, amazing spiritual woman who can do no wrong and is just divinely amazing, but is usually very boring and doesn't do anything. Or you've got the Eve characters, who are usually more interesting because they do things that are more interesting to us as modern readers. They do things that are like, oh, that's fun, I can relate to this character. But they're usually considered, you know, bad. They're usually considered moral lessons for people to learn, like, don't be like this or else this will happen. And that's another way that we know that it's an Eve kind of archetype, because usually all hell is broken loose on them in order for them to learn their lessons. So something goes wrong in their story and everything goes tits up. So they have to learn to not be this Eve character. And when we look at the Mabinogi, Welsh medieval literature, there are characters that could fit into those two categories, such as in the first branch of the Mabinogi, there is a unnamed character. She's an unnamed wife of a male character called Arawn. And she is described as being one of the most intelligent, one of the most noble women he ever meets. And she's gorgeous, she's glorious, but she's also like a philosopher at heart. So she's a Mary. She fits into Mary because, like I said, she's got all these virtuous qualities to her, but she's boring. She doesn't do anything. But then you have the Eve-like character represented in like Blodeuwedd. Now, Blodeuwedd is an interesting one because she is a woman who is created purely for a man within the story, which is very reminiscent of Eve's story in the Bible, of course. That whole idea that she is created purely to be a wife to a man, and she doesn't want to be his wife. She, in the story of Blodeuwedd, she doesn't want to be this guy's wife. So she ends up kind of trying to murder him in the story. And then it all goes wrong for her. She does end up kind of murdering him, but instead of dying, he transforms into an eagle. And then a wizard turns him back into his normal self. But due to her kind of attempted murder of her husband, she ends up punished and transformed into an owl. And when she transforms into the owl, her name is changed to Blodeuwedd. So Blodeuwedd, her original name, means of the flowers because she was made from flowers. And then Blodeuwedd means flower face, which was a colloquial term for the owl in Wales for a long time because, you know, owls kind of look like they have a flower for a face. And the reason she was turned into an owl is described in the story because owls are considered the most hated, the most feared of all the birds. They are the birds that are stuck in the dark. They're constantly only hunting at night, and all the other birds hate them, despise them, and fly away from them in fear. So therefore, she's going to live a life of darkness and solitude as an owl forever. So she's punished in the same way that Eve is in the Bible. So as I said, you have those two types of characters within the Mabinogi as well, these Mary and Eve characters. But then you have characters that you cannot fit into those two medieval categories. So it's another, to me, sign that these stories are older than the medieval period, because there are some of these female characters who are some of the most interesting and intriguing characters in our mythology that just don't fit those molds. So, for example, Rhiannon, who is one of the kind of most popular and most well-known entities from our mythology, she doesn't fit either of those categories because, yes, she's beautiful, she's noble, she's regal, she's wonderfully intelligent, she's a philosopher at heart, she's amazing. But she also is very transgressive and she's her own authority. She's independent. She's unique. So, for example, a sign of her independence and just the fact that she is very much an authority of her own identity is her introduction in the stories. When she's spotted by a guy, she's very magical. There's a lot of motifs around her that kind of hint that she's from the other world, that she's not quite of this world, that she's divine or she's from the other world. And she appears riding this glorious white horse. And this guy decides, I want that. I want her, that thing that's on the horse. I want it. And he sends his men to go and get her. And none of these men can catch up to her on horseback. And she doesn't seem to be even trying to get away from them. She's just kind of trotting idly by and they just can't get to her. And after try, they just can't find her. So eventually the guy who sent them goes, I'll go get her then. And he tries and he tries and he still just can't get her until eventually he goes, lady, for the one that you love the most, please stop. And she stops and she turns to him. And the first thing she says to him is, you know, for the sake of your horse, it would have been better if you asked me that ages ago. So literally just telling him, you know, why didn't you just ask me? Why did you have to chase me? Why did you have to try and own me in that way? Why couldn't you have just asked me and, you know, put the ownership of whether or not I want to stop on me? Because I did stop once you asked, didn't I? And that to me is quite a feminist kind of way of thinking. And it's strange to think that she's a character that was written about in the medieval period like this. And it's the same throughout that entire first story. She's a very kind of cunning woman. She comes up with this grand plan when everything goes wrong in the story and the male main character screws up. it's not him that fixes the situation. It's her. It's Rhiannon. She's the one who comes up with the plan, who puts the plan into motion, and who fixes the situation entirely. And then as the story progresses, she becomes this kind of hated and feared character because she is wrongfully accused of murdering her own son and eating her own son as well. And she doesn't really know if the people who accused her are telling the truth because her son is missing. So during the process of grieving this son that's missing, the son that she's just given birth to has gone missing, she can't even grieve because she's already put in a position where she's accused of his murder. And she's not even sure, did I do it? I don't know. I don't remember doing it, but these people are saying I did. So she takes on a punishment, and her punishment is essentially to become a horse. She becomes a horse and has to let people ride upon her back as they enter into the city that she governs over, and she has to tell them the story of how she murdered and ate her own child, even though she didn't. And eventually, when she does find the child, she says to him, as she hugs him and holds him tight, when she finally finds that he's alive, she says, which translates to, well, that's the end of my anxiety. And then, because within this kind of tradition, it was believed that it was the mother's job to give a child a name, that becomes his name, Prideri, which essentially means separation anxiety. And so Rhiannon is this really interesting character who has her own kind of authority and her own power and her own presence, devoid of a man. She doesn't need a man. And yet she also does have men around her that rely on her. She's almost like this embodiment of sovereignty. It is with her that the king of the region she marries becomes an even greater king. So she almost gives him the authority and the sovereignty to rule by just being there. And she goes from this divine, beautiful, amazing being to this beast of burden who goes through so much traumas and endures so much. And even in later stories that bring her up, when things go wrong in the stories, she's always the one to go, right, I'll sort it, I can fix this. And I love that about her. But again, she doesn't fit into the mold of being either Mary or Eve within that medieval context. And another character that also does that is Arianrhod, who is also very popular today. Arianrhod is a character that is inherently transgressive in every way. So there's this king called Math, who is also her uncle, but we won't get into that. There's a king called Math who, in order to rule over Gwynedd, the kingdom that he rules, he always has to have his feet in the lap of a virgin. And unfortunately, the virgin that he had his feet on the lap of is not a virgin anymore, shall we say. It's quite a sad story of why she's not a virgin. But she's not a virgin anymore, so she's not eligible. So he needs a new virgin. And Arianrhod, his niece, turns around and says, I'll be your virgin. I will be your foothold. And in order to test whether or not she's a virgin, the only way, of course, that they can test whether she's a virgin is for her to step over her uncle's magic wand, which in itself is a bit strange. But she does this, and as she does, two things kind of plop out of her. These two little, like, there's this one crotch goblin that comes out of her and instantly is given a name, Dulan, and then crawls into the sea. The other thing that comes out of her, which some have kind of theorized is perhaps afterbirth, is just kind of this shapeless, formless thing. And her brother, Gwydion, picks it up, wraps it in a blanket and puts it in a cupboard. And over time, it incubates and turns into a baby. But she runs off and she doesn't give a crap about these things that she's given birth to. She's just embarrassed and she's lost her dignity in this situation. So she runs off and she goes to live on her island called Caer Arianrhod. And then a few years later, Gwydion, her brother, comes to her and is like, you have this child, give him a name. And she scorns it. She scorns motherhood. She refuses it. And that in itself is transgressive in the fact that she refuses the role that was traditionally placed upon women in that period. You know, women weren't supposed to scorn motherhood. Women were supposed to embrace motherhood. So there's this woman who's going, no, I don't want to be a mother. I gave birth to that without my consent. I'm not taking the responsibility for it. And in that, she is just inherently like quite empowering as a woman. She very much embodies a lot of traits that we would consider very modern. And yet she's a character who's very, very old. And she's just glorious in that respect. And both of these characters, Rhiannon and Arianrhod, are deeply woven into the idea of magic, because Rhiannon, as I said, is very otherworldly. She has these birds called the Adar Rhiannon, which are supposedly able to lull you into a sleep-like state, a trance-like state, where the sick and the hurt no longer feel their pain, and the dead can rise again, be with you. So it's this kind of liminal state of being as the birds sing around you. She also has like magical tools, like a sack that is never ending, kind of like Mary Poppins bags. And she also rides upon a horse that can trot faster than any other horse can gallop at the highest speeds. So she is inherently magical in that respect. And also then Arianrhod is considered quite magical because she places these things called tangeds upon her child because she refuses to be a mother. She doesn't want to be a mother. So she places these three tangeds. Now, tanged doesn't really translate into English very well. Some translations of the stories translate it to mean curse, but it's not quite a curse. It's more like a fate. It's your fate that she's placing upon you. And the fate that she places upon him is that he will never have a name. He will never have weapons, because weapons were very important in that period, for a man especially. And he will never have a wife that is of mortal stock. Eventually, all three of those fates are broken by a wizard called Gwydion, her brother, who tricks her. He's kind of considered the like Loki of Welsh mythology because he's very tricksy and does things that kind of get under your skin. But he causes these tangeds, these fates, to be broken. So he does get a name, and he's named Hjeihjau Gafes, which is really interesting because essentially Arianrhod, this name that means the silver mound, the silver wheel, or sometimes it means the axle of the wheel, the center still point of the wheel, she gave birth to Hje, which means light. So the axle of the wheel, the thing that is the central still point of the ever-turning wheel, gave birth to light. And that is kind of mythological, I consider. But he's given a name, Hjeihjau Gafes. He's given weapons via trickery. And then the wife that is not of mortal stock is that woman that I talked about earlier, Vodeyath, who was made of flowers. So all these women, they embody these ideas that are just inherently transgressive and inherently, I suppose, feminist is the only way we can put it, is like they're really cool characters, and their magic and their witchcraft is just a small part of what makes them so impressive. And I always say to people always focus on the male characters in Welsh mythology, the scholars and such, but it's the women characters that are the most interesting and have the most interesting stories, I think.
It's so fascinating to me how, you know, these medieval manuscripts, as you're talking about, you know, they're seen as these kind of Christianized texts, but then we have evidence of these women who are clearly older. This is true of the Irish medieval texts as well, and those that were written about the Grail from Britain as a whole. And it's so interesting how we're coming back into this time where we can identify with these women. And I kind of wonder, you know, as these medieval storytellers were telling the story of Arianrhod and Rhiannon, how people would have reacted. Was there a sense of fear around these women because they didn't fit into that mold? And so I'm always curious how these stories evolve over time and how the listeners really interpret them based on the time and the culture and the context. And we are in this amazing time where we're looking at these women going, these women are clearly older. They come from an older tradition, and we're now sort of reclaiming their power. This is very, very powerful. So thank you so much for that beautiful overview. And I could listen to you talk about it all day. Just kind of following on from that conversation, I would really love to hear from your perspective, what can the women of Welsh mythology teach us about ourselves? You know, how are their stories relevant to us as modern women?
I think the best way to answer that question is by paraphrasing one of my mentors, Christopher Hughes. He's glorious, and he's written a lot of books on the subject of Welsh mythology and Druidry. He's the chief of the Anglesey Druid Order. And he says this phrase that has always stuck with me throughout my life. And he says it quite often whenever he teaches courses and such. So it's really embedded into me. And the phrase is that mythology is a thing that never, ever happened. It never happened. They are stories that just never, ever happened. But they happen to us all the time. They happen to us all the time. And the reason that that has always stuck with me, the way that he's said this, is that It's true. The reason that we turn to these stories isn't because they're fun stories and they're cool. It's because they're important and they're relevant and they reflect an aspect of who we are as a culture, as a society, and also as individuals. And I love that about them. You know, the fact that these stories have never kind of gone out of fashion, people are always looking towards them. And I remember when I first discovered how popular Welsh mythology was. Wales is a strange nation because we're not very well known worldwide. A lot of people don't even know we exist. I remember when I went to university, there was a lot of people who would ask me where I was from. And when I said Cymru or Wales, they would go, "Where's that?" Or they would go, "Oh, is that like a part of England?" And it would always kind of grind me. It would get on my nerves. So I always thought we were kind of this unknown place that was irrelevant to the world. And yet, when you really think about it, we've had such an influence on a lot of the world, especially via our stories, our myths and our legends. We wouldn't have Tolkien or Game of Thrones or even possibly Harry Potter or anything like that if it wasn't for the influence of these stories. There are so many motifs that are taken directly from these stories that are very relevant in our modern fantasy scene. And then beyond that, on a more embodied spiritual level, you also have to just look around right now and notice that there are so many people connecting to these characters on a visceral level. It's really odd in my eyes that there is someone over in Michigan or Minnesota right now probably praying to Ceridwen, who is from a lake that is like a few miles down the road from me. It's really strange to think that there is somebody who is praying to Rhiannon, who is doing a spell with Rhiannon probably right now all the way in Sydney, Australia, who has probably never walked on the landscape of Wales, and yet they're calling to a goddess who is so rooted in the part of South Wales that I visited not too long ago. And it's a strange and odd thing to think about, but it's also really beautiful and really magical, because it showcases to me that the things that are embedded into my cultural heritage, the things that I grew up with, are just so universal that they're speaking to people across the world from various cultures. And that means that they're very relevant. To me personally, these characters have taught me so much about myself and about my culture and about my land that I think anyone can have that, regardless of whether they are in Wales or not, regardless of whether they're from here. I think there's something they can teach us about sovereignty, and that could be sovereignty of the land or sovereignty of self, the way that we walk in the world. They also teach us to stand our ground, you know, to really like just be authentic in who we are. Ariandrod didn't buckle and change herself in order to fit into the ways that she was expected to be. Neither did Blodeuwedd. Blodeuwedd, who was purely created and crafted for one purpose only, she refused that. She'd said, "That's not the life I want for myself." And she stood headstrong in herself. And I think these women are like strange because they come from a period where we are trained to believe women didn't have much power. And yet here they are, really powerful women, standing proud in their own authenticity, in their own integrity, and in their own authority, I suppose, of their own bodies, of their own being, of their own self. And I think we can learn a lot from them in that regard.
I resonate so much, and it speaks to so much of my own feelings and beliefs and practices with the ancestral traditions from Ireland and from England, and how these ancient goddesses and these mythic women can really support us to be our sovereign selves and help us connect to land and lineage no matter where we are in the world. And it's such a magical thing to be able to go back to these medieval texts and these traditions and really see ourselves within them and see, you know, this really beautiful ancestral connection or this connection of culture and heritage. And so, yeah, I'm thinking about, you know, that hypothetical woman in Michigan and Sydney, Australia, and feeling that sense of connection to something greater than themselves, to their ancestry, to their heritage, to these goddesses who are this archetypal energy of power and sovereignty and so much more that can help us to connect with ourselves. We just have a few minutes left, and I would love to revisit a conversation that Mara and I were having before we got on the live, where Mara was talking about Anglesey and this beautiful story about this river. So Mara, I'm going to have you maybe just repeat some of that because it was so beautiful. And anyways, I'll pass over to you because I would love for the listeners to hear some of that story.
Absolutely. So I think the story that we were talking about is very reminiscent of just how important the oral traditions of our culture is as well. Because though we have these stories that are written down in books like the Mabinogi, I do feel that once these stories are kind of put to pen to paper, like they're changed slightly and they lose a little bit of their enchantment, even though it's really good that they have been preserved and they are carried over to other cultures and such because of that. But at the same time, I grew up in a landscape where these entities were alive. They were very much, you know, part of my upbringing and my heritage, and as well as just they were around me at all times. And I think the goddess that I'm going to mention now is probably one of the first goddesses I ever interacted with in my youth. So I grew up on Ynysmon, as I mentioned in the beginning. Ynysmon is an island that is very well known for its agriculture and its history of like feeding the rest of Wales and such, its farming traditions. And through kind of the western side of Anglesey, there's this river that cuts through the island that almost, if you look at it on a map, seems to cut the island in half. And it's this really diverse and beautiful river because in some parts of the river, it's this really wide, expansive, deep and gushing river. And then on the other parts, it's this small, like trickling stream that doesn't seem to leave much of an impact on the environment around it. And this river is just so much part of the everyday culture. So like we cross over it on bridges when we go to any of the towns on the island, or if we need to cross off the island, if we need to go onto the mainland, we have to cross over that river. If you come from where I'm from on the island, there's no getting around it. You have to cross over the river. And I never really knew the river's name when I was younger. I just remember thinking it was a very beautiful river and it was glorious. There's a part of the river that have these glorious stepping stones that have been put there many, many centuries ago now. And these stepping stones allowed people to cross the river back before there was any bridges built and such. And it's just such a glorious place. And I came to discover not long after I came into paganism that the name of the river is Braint. Now, Braint is a fun word because in Welsh, it can mean pride. It can mean like a pride in yourself. So Dwi'n teimlo braint would be a phrase that means like I'm feeling pride in myself. But it can also mean fraid or Bridget. So it's a Welshification of the word fraid, which is in itself a Welshification of the word Bridget or Bridget. And of course, Bridget or Bridget is a goddess within the kind of Irish continuum, as well as a saint. And over in Wales, she is as well. She's Saint Fraid or she's Braint. But the Braint is specifically the river. And what I loved learning about the river was that the river itself kind of floods and destroys the landscape every winter. It just stretches past its boundaries and it floods the landscape so beautifully. And a lot of the people on the island, they hate this. They can't stand that the river floods every year. They're like, oh God, here we go again. All the fields are going to be mucky and wet and everything's going to be destroyed and my garden's going to be full of water. But the thing is, once that water then recedes and goes away over the warmer months in the spring and the summer, the nutrients that are left in the soil around the river are so rich that all the crops that grow there are just amazing and brilliant. And the thing about the island is called Mon, which, as I mentioned, comes from the Roman Mona, or probably comes from an older Brythonic word before that. But the Romans recorded it as Mona, so it kind of stayed within cultural memory as Mona and then became Mon. And Mon is, within folk tradition in Wales, is referred to as Mon Mam Cymru. And this title that was placed upon the island is one that we can stretch back into the depths of history and find written about in the 11th and 12th centuries. But it's possibly older than that. It's some kind of colloquial term that was probably used within common vernacular long before it was written down. But Mon Mam Cymru means Mon, the mother of Wales, or Mona, the mother of Wales. And the longer version of that saying is Mon Mam Cymru Nain y Byd, Mon, the mother of Wales, the grandmother of the world. And it was these crops, these gorgeous and glorious crops that fed the entirety of Wales and even parts of Europe and England got their crops from Mona, from the island, so that they could feed the nation. So she's this kind of mother goddess that has been feeding so much of the world for so very many years, and she still continues to. There are still so many crops that get exported from the island. And what's really interesting is that during a huge drought that happened in around, I think it was 2014, or maybe it was a bit earlier than that, the river really, really like kind of shriveled and almost died into nothingness in this intense heat that we had. The grasses around the fields and such were just yellow and looked like they'd burned to death. And during that period, there was some archaeological work going on, trying to figure out some of the remnants of the prehistoric inhabitants of the island. And of course, Mona, Morn, Anglesey, very much associated with Druids and has a long history of being one of the teaching places of the Druids, according to classical writers, as well as being the last place that the Druids lived in all of Britain before they were destroyed by the Roman army. So there's a lot of interest around Anglesey. There's numerous sacred sites on the island, beautiful ancient monuments. You can't kick a rock on Anglesey, essentially, without it being some sort of sacred ancient monument. And during this period of this great drought, while this archaeological work was going on, they found carved into one of the fields this gloriously huge goddess-like figure. And she's gorgeous. She just looks like this beautiful harvest or earth goddess just carved into the field. And they estimated that this carved goddess was about 3,000 years old, possibly. And she's there, right on the bank of the river, right on the river that's called Braint. And Braint now, to me, is a goddess. If she wasn't in the past, I would be very, very surprised. I think our ancestors obviously knew there was something to her that was inherently magical. And the fact that she floods the landscape and causes all the nutrients to come and it causes, you know, Mona to become this great mother who feeds the nation with her crops. That goddess is there now as proof to me that there was obviously something going on thousands of years ago that our ancestors knew about. And yet we also know about today because, like I said, she was one of the first goddesses that I interacted with because she's a river that's so integrally important to the culture of the island to this day. And I remember connecting to her. And I have a little story in my book where I mentioned that I dreamt of her when I was younger. I dreamt that I was bathing in the river next to her. And I didn't know her name at that point. And then I learned her name and it was like all these doors opened. And nowadays I go and I leave offerings and I tend to the river and I sing to the river as often as I can because she to me is Braint, but she's also a part of the landscape of Mona, the mother of Wales as well.
So beautiful to feel the way that this archaeological sort of exploration was happening and then the goddess appeared. And it's amazing that she's appearing to us at this time where we are remembering these sacred ways and mm-hmm. the feminine is coming through in this really beautiful way. And I love that you dreamed of her as a child and it's just so magical. So thank you so much for sharing that with us. And since you mentioned your book, I would love to give you some time here to talk a little bit about your book and anything else that you want to share with everyone listening, where they can find you and what have you.
Absolutely. So I have written a book. So if you'd like to hear more about the magic of Wales, my book is called Welsh Witchcraft, A Guide to the Spirits, Lore and Magic of Wales. It came out not too long ago and it's available wherever books are sold. So you can order it on the dreaded sites like Amazon, but you can also order it through your local booksellers, which is what I recommend. Go to your local bookshop and ask them if they can order it in, if you can. If you have an interest in it, of course. And that book kind of covers the history of witchcraft and magic in Wales, as well as the gods and goddesses. It covers fairy folk and the traditions of the kind of annual cycle throughout the year, the ways in which people celebrated throughout the year. And it was quite a passion project of mine. I'm currently working on a second book, which should be coming out next year. So stay tuned for that one. But yes, I'm also a bit like a rash. I get around. Once you've rubbed up against me, you can't get rid of me. So now that you've seen me, I will pop up everywhere. So I'm across all socials, Instagram, TikTok. I'm a bit of a fool on TikTok and I run around sharing stories about fairies and magic and wonder. And I'm also on places like YouTube. And you can find me on all these sites just under Mara Starling. Careful with the Mara because there is a hidden H in there. So it's M-H-A-R-A. It's a very hidden silent H. So Mara Starling. And you can find me on pretty much every social media. And I like to share as much as I can about the magic of Wales via those places, as well as on my Patreon, in my books, and in my work. So come find me if you feel the call of Wales.
Thank you so much for sharing. I see a question in the chat here. Someone's asking, what is your second book going to be about? Maybe it's something secret and you're not ready to talk about it yet, but if you are, someone is interested.
I'm not sure if I'm technically allowed to talk about it, but I will give a little bit of an insight into what it is. The second book, so the first book that I wrote, Welsh Witchcraft, was kind of a very much introductory overview of witchcraft and magic, and it was very much focused on how we can be inspired and informed of these like myths and legends and these stories to create an embodied and authentic practice that is inspired by these things. All my books going forward are going to be more of like, we're going to take a theme that I talked about in the first book and go deeper, as deep as we can. And the second book specifically goes deeper on the topic of the other world and the magic of the fair folk and everything that that encompasses. So when I tell people that my next book is kind of about fairies, they often get either really excited because they like fairies, or they get disappointed because maybe they're not that interested in fairies. But the thing is, the fairy tradition in Wales is so rooted in things like Rhiannon. Rhiannon is so associated with the fairy tradition, and we go into that in the book, as well as other gods like Arawn and Gwynap Nudd. They come up a lot. And then we have like so much that plays a role within our folklore mythology that influences the way in which we perceive magic and such. So like, for example, witchcraft, if you have an interest in witchcraft, fairies are very much embedded in witchcraft traditions of Wales, because we have this belief that a lot of magical practitioners gained their knowledge and expertise, not from the devil, like was believed over the border, but from fairies. And so we have a lot of these native practitioners who used to work with the fairies. So my second book is going to be delving into that. I'm currently on a deadline to finish it as soon as possible. I've written most of it, but I need to finish it. And hopefully that should be out next year.
Thank you so much for giving us some insight. That feels really, really exciting. And I'm seeing some lovely comments in the chat. Thank you so much. Thank you all for listening, those of you who've been listening along with us. It's been such a powerful conversation and such an honor to be here with you, Mara. So just a big thank you. And I also really want to honor and thank the ancestors that we called in at the beginning of this conversation. I feel that they've been holding this conversation the whole time we've been chatting, and I can really feel how this wisdom you're sharing is so wanting to be remembered, especially for people of Welsh ancestry and Welsh heritage. And I just really, really bow in gratitude for all that you're bringing forward, Mara. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Diolch o galon, as we say in Welsh, diolch o galon. Thank you so much for having me on. And yes, bendithion disglaed I chi gyd.
This has been another beautiful podcast episode. And just a reminder, there are lots of other episodes with lots of beautiful guests for you to explore here on Dreaming the Ancestors. So until next time, everyone, a big, big thank you.